Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutin.
You're watching Consider This, the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Tonight, we explore how one of our neighbours, home to a large part of the Malaysian diaspora, has coped with the pandemic. In the democracy that Australia is, there is a vibrant debate at the federal and state levels about pandemic management, from citywide lockdowns to the use of the AstraZeneca vaccine for young people. Now, former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull recently called the slow pace of the vaccination program, quote, the worst failure of public administration, end quote. Nevertheless, the projections suggest that 72% of the Australian population of 16 years of age will have at least one dose by the end of the year. So tonight on the show, we're going to reflect on Australia's COVID-19 response. Joining us on the show tonight is Professor Catherine Bennett. She's the Chair in Epidemiology at the Faculty of Health of Deakin University. She's also the President of the Council of Academic Public Health Institutions of Australia. Professor Bennett, thank you so much for joining us on the show tonight. It's a pleasure to have you. Begin our conversation tonight by getting you to explain to us currently what the situation is with Australia's vaccination program. What is the current status, the current situation as we understand it?
Well, we started later than a lot of countries because we were pretty much at COVID zero at the start of the year. So we waited for the full safety data and got our approvals in February. And then a few weeks after that, that was Pfizer and then AstraZeneca. So we had two vaccines that we were planning to administer. Like other countries, we built a strategy that targeted our most vulnerable and our most exposed, so the frontline workers and aged care, for example, in those first groups to be vaccinated. But by the time we started rolling out AstraZeneca, which was going to be key in our rollout because we could produce it onshore, the first doses were coming into Australia, but we had onshore which production, which meant we had a better supply option. But what we found was that just at the time, within the first weeks or so of rolling that out, that we had the information coming in about those possible rare side effects that then did change the way we structured our program. So instead of offering Pfizer to the initially to the frontline workers and AstraZeneca to the general population, we then put age differences in. So initially those who were 50 and above could have AstraZeneca, but the preferred vaccine for those 50 and below became Pfizer. And we've since shifted that to cut off to 60 years of age. So there's been a few things going on that have actually impacted the rollout very early in that that stage where actually public confidence and getting your systems in place and making sure it's all working well is so critical. So there was a timing issue and we also had supply issues trying to get those two vaccines into Australia initially. So that got us off to a bit of a slow start.
Okay, Catherine, could you help us understand a little bit about the structure of the healthcare system and a bit of the politics? Because I understand there were differences between the federal government and in a case of the AstraZeneca debate with the Queensland state government. How does it work? Is there a single policy for Australia, or are states allowed to sort of deal with these things autonomously?
It's a very good question, and it is part of our political structure that we are a federation of states. So we have our five states and two territories under the Commonwealth government. The federal government actually is in charge of the vaccine rollout. They coordinated this centrally. They negotiated the arrangements with the producers of the vaccine, and they also really built that strategy for who we would target and what the phases would be. But it's a partnership with states who have now established state-run vaccine centres, so the vaccine hubs where you can get more people vaccinated in one dose. One of the characteristics of the Australian program was using our primary healthcare, so our general practitioners, our doctors in the community, so that particularly people who are older, have their own doctor, have complex medical issues, could go and see their doctor and be vaccinated. And that was also managed through the Commonwealth government. So it was a bit of a mix between state and Commonwealth. And while states could make some of their own decisions about, you know, how they were running their vaccine hubs, it was still under this broad strategy. And they were relying on the Commonwealth to provide their supply. So they couldn't go too off piece, because then they would, it'd be clear that they wouldn't necessarily have the vaccines to do the second dose if they vaccinated too many people in one go. So there's been a lot going on in that space, which I think really shows that sometimes a federation doesn't work for you, because the organisational side is at state level, but it needs to be nationally coordinated. And our Australian government really isn't set up at that level for that operational health program.
Just on the note of coordination, Catherine, I mean, I'm just wondering, you know, if I were to reference the AstraZeneca debate, what has that done in terms of messaging to the public? I mean, has that created a sense of hesitancy or scepticism, or in any way kind of uncertainty when it comes to getting vaccinated?
Absolutely. You know, there are a few things contributing to people being slow to vaccinate. There are the people that, you know, have our anti-vaxxers like everywhere, but there were particularly people who were just confused about the process. They weren't sure when they were eligible or how to get the vaccine. But there was another group, and a growing group, who were concerned about the health messaging and weren't sure about these side effects. No matter how rare they are, people focus on those side effects. And in fact, that became the an added level of confusion between state and federal politicians today, when we have our broad preference at the Commonwealth level is, as I said, the people below 50 now have AstraZeneca, do not have AstraZeneca, that Pfizer is their preferred vaccine. That hasn't changed. That's been in place. It's still regulated. The approval still extends to people who are 18 and over. So if people really wanted AstraZeneca, they could go and they could have a conversation with their doctor and then sign the approval. So it had to be informed consent. But they've changed things at the government level nationally to help GPs in that process. So there's professional indemnity insurance and a few other things that were acting as barriers, which they removed this week. But then in the process of going out and saying, so it's okay now, you can go and see your doctor if you're under 40 and you want AstraZeneca, go and have that conversation. The main thing is it's an informed choice. But the states then said, no, we don't want people to have AstraZeneca if they're below 40. We don't want someone to die from that, and, you know, who wouldn't have died from COVID. And it was just very strange messaging, because the risk, we have had two deaths in Australia, but we've rolled out, you know, 4.6 million doses, and these were people with, you know, other health issues here. So talking about death from clotting in that setting and appearing to contradict the Australian government view then just started a whole furore today. But it really does, as you say, challenge the public health messaging. So those of us who are out there, and that's our concern, are trying to work in a very difficult environment to bring it back to a calm conversation and explain what the risks are and how you go about having your own conversations and making your own decisions.
Right, Catherine, you know, fascinating how GPs are so important to the discussion, as I understand it, and this expression, balance of risk, that is used, and I believe that there are also attempts to create devices or, you know, applications that will help an individual decide what the balance of risk is when it comes to vaccination. But underscoring this, is the possibility of choice that is available in Australia, vaccine choice that is not available in many countries. So in a country where vaccine choice is not available, what would you recommend?
Well, in a way, it's not always available to us. If you want, if you're over 60 and you would like Pfizer, you can't have it. That's not an option for you, because our supply isn't sufficient to give everybody choice. Just as if you want your vaccine now, but you don't want AstraZeneca and you're under 40, you or under 50, you are, or under 60, in fact, you can't have it. You have to then wait till Pfizer becomes available, because we do have a slow feed of Pfizer. So, in fact, we're in the same situation, really. We only have the choice of having it now and switching vaccines for those who are under 60. So if you don't have a choice, as we don't, over 60 now, it really is about helping people understand what risk and benefit means in this setting. If you don't have a major wave of COVID in your country, it's not the same as people saying, I don't want to die, or I don't want to bring the virus into my home. I don't want our health systems to be overwhelmed. We've been protected from that by having these, you know, very strict approaches to closing down every outbreak as soon as we can with strict interventions. So people are weighing up a different kind of risk here. They don't have that same sense of what the virus might do in your own country, but also they've now become almost complacent, but they have this view that we've worked so hard to keep our borders closed and keep the virus out, that that's where everyone's effort seems to be. So there is quite a proportion of the population who want COVID zero, so the vaccine takes a back seat. You spend all your focus on trying to keep the virus out. And of course, that's not sustainable. That's not going to last forever.
All right, Professor Bennett, we're going to take a quick break, but let's come back and talk precisely about that, about those border closures and the mandatory quarantines and how they've been very effective in keeping the virus out of Australia. But what's next in this next phase of the pandemic? Let's come back and talk a little bit about that. Stay tuned to Consider This. Hi, thanks so much for staying with Sharad and I on Consider This. Let's continue our conversation tonight with Professor Catherine Bennett, Chair in Epidemiology at Deakin University in Australia. Catherine, coming back to something you said a little bit before the break, talking about border closures that happened in the start of the pandemic. So Australia's border closures, a mandatory quarantine system, that was all highly effective, worked in keeping the case numbers low. I'm just wondering whether policies that were great at the start of the pandemic may not be as effective in the later stages. And what is Australia's thinking about that? Has there been a shift in terms of the public health management beyond just border closures?
That's right. They were very successful. We brought in our complete closure, managed closure of our international borders very early on, by the late February, and that made a big difference. It stopped new cases coming in. We had imported a lot of cases, but we managed to get the entire country to COVID zero. And so we had stopped community transmission of those initial variants. But even before we finished that, we had more variants cross the international borders. We had set up a hotel quarantine system so that we were in a position to manage the people coming in. They could be isolated for 14 days. We were testing people. But hotels weren't designed for quarantine. And we started to see these breakthroughs where someone might get infected who was a worker there and then take the virus home and get in the community. So we had a number of outbreaks, including the big wave in Melbourne. And over that time, we realised our public health responses, our test, trace and isolate, really, we didn't have the capacity. We couldn't scale that up quickly, particularly in Victoria. So a lot of work had to be done to rebuild our public health system so it could support this scale of public health response. So by the end of the second wave in Victoria, New South Wales had running waves because they also had cases cross the border from our state. Ended up really building that system so we could test on scale, we could get to cases very quickly, go to their contacts and their secondary contacts, quarantine them until we realised whether they were at risk or not. And so there was a whole process around it. But at some point, you know, you have to look to lockdown, and the second wave was out of control. So we went into a very long 3-month lockdown in Victoria, nearly. But now we've got into a cycle of circuit breakers. So because the contact tracing struggles to keep up with the virus, particularly these new variants, what they're doing is bringing in lockdowns, which might be a city or it might be a whole state of 6.5 million people, in order to try and get on top of it, because the turnover between someone's exposure and them becoming infectious themselves is that bit tighter now. It makes it very difficult to use our standard methods. So the variants are really challenging us and making it more obvious where we do still have some gaps in our borders and in our whole process of managing people coming into the country. So at the moment we have multiple outbreaks, and we do have 5 states and territories with some level of lockdown. And this all happened over the last 2 weeks with 4 different events occurring that meant the virus got back into the community. So we do move away from that kind of thinking, because we can't hold this off at the borders anymore.
So what are the implications then for a lockdown as a tool? I mean, is there pushback on it? In some countries, as it is in Malaysia, it's devastating to the economy. The people are not getting enough support throughout these lockdown scenarios. And also the conversation about COVID becoming endemic. Is that starting to shift the balance of thinking among public policy formulators?
Sure, that's a really good question. And we have, in fact, started at different times to go down that path of having that big conversation about how we do transition out of this COVID zero mentality, which worked when you were holding the borders, but it isn't actually helping our vaccination rollout. And so if you end up with a point where your borders give way and your people aren't vaccinated at high enough levels, then all we've done is hold off the inevitable wave of cases and serious illness. So that's the real concern. And many of us are actually pushing now that we do move into that bigger conversation about how we track from here to endemic COVID, to living with COVID. And that's got to be holding off, protecting our elderly. We do have good vaccination rates now with our aged care, for example, so that's a relief. But we're not there yet with the broader population, particularly the older parts of the population. So we've still got some work to do. We still have to hold the virus back. But at the moment, so much work's going into these lockdowns, which are incredibly costly, and not just economically, socially, and with other health impacts as well. You know, we can't just keep going into this cycle indefinitely. So I think the outbreaks now, as terrible as they are and as impactful as they are forcing people to face the fact that this isn't that kind of hold it off, we'll deal with a vaccine next year, we'll wait and see what happens. This is temporary, and we want to move to COVID, living with COVID on our terms, not just because the virus overwhelms us with these new, very infectious variants.
Can I ask you, Catherine, if there's been conversations in Australia about herd immunity, and what is the thinking around herd immunity? What kind of levels of vaccination is Australia looking at in thinking about turning the tables on this virus?
Well, I think we're very conservative in many respects around risk. And in fact, I would say we're now very risk averse, and some of our states incredibly so. You know, they shut their state borders very quickly now. So it shows that there's just no tolerance for any level of risk. And that has its own consequences. In fact, one of these current outbreaks is because someone who was very low risk in Australia, who was in a state where there'd been a case, you know, somewhere else, they went into another state for work reasons. They were put into hotel quarantine, picked up the virus in hotel quarantine from a return traveller, and then that led to the outbreak in a mining centre, which has sent the virus across Australia. So, you know, sometimes being risk averse actually comes with its own danger. And I think we've kind of crossed a line there. So, but with that, everyone recognises ideally you'd want 80-85% vaccination rates would be fantastic amongst your eligible adults. We probably won't get there. If we get to 75-80, that would be great. But I think there's a growing realisation that herd immunity, we're not going to get to levels that eradicate the virus globally. So we are talking about endemic virus. And so then what you're looking at is the benefits of every extra 5% of immunity you have in your population and what that allows you to do in relation to borders, whether you allow vaccinated people to come in without quarantine, just with testing. So we're looking at those steps that might start to happen. But the conversations haven't happened yet, and we really need them to happen, because otherwise I think we need that conversation to actually give the context to the vaccination program so people know where we're heading. Mm-hmm. And then that gets them on board, because unless we get people vaccinated, it won't be safe to move to these steps. And the virus is telling us it's not going to wait. So, you know, we have to actually get on with this, or else we could be caught out and the virus might get away from us in the community, and that could be quite devastating.
Catherine, can I ask you a little bit about vaccine choice? And because of the choices now have implications for travel and accreditation in different regions of the world, what is the Australian conversation there, considering there are so many more vaccine options than just Pfizer, AstraZeneca and Moderna?
Yeah, that's an interesting topic. Again, because we haven't had the big conversations at the national level, I hear what other experts say, and I think there's consensus that it's not every vaccine is not equal. And if you're talking about what you can do at your borders, you know, everyone who gets vaccinated doesn't have the same response to the vaccine either. But I think at the end of the day, you're not talking about complete guaranteed immunity when you have someone with a vaccine card coming into your country. So I think what we're looking at is having some level of kind of global recognition of vaccines. Probably the WHO recognized list gives you a working list to work from. And then you go with that, recognizing that there will be some risk that you will have people who are maybe effectively unvaccinated in amongst that group, but that you can cope with that. You know, this is actually about suppressing the risk of transmission in a community, even if people come in with the virus across the borders. What I think we're going to worry about longer term isn't just the virus. It'll be vaccine escape variants or variants associated with particularly serious illness. And I think that's what we will move to. We will stop tracking every case. We will stop testing everybody for COVID, but we will have surveillance at our borders and sentinel surveillance in our population to understand what variants are circulating and whether any other variants have emerged that we should be worried about and we might want to close down.
Just on the note of variants, I'm curious because you talked a little bit about the long-term picture, but I'm just wondering in terms of the short-term picture, specifically with the Delta variant. I understand that the Delta variant has just completely changed the landscape of COVID in Australia completely and the need to approach pandemic management. Can you tell me, in terms of short-term pandemic management, what is the game plan for the Delta variant?
Well, I think the concern is that even our best contact tracing, So we did have a Delta outbreak in Melbourne and we didn't know it had started until 3 weeks later when it was found because we were following up another outbreak. And then they discovered there was not just this Kappa, the other Indian variant outbreak, but Delta as well. But that was less than 20 cases. It actually didn't take off, even though it was an unmitigated, you know, little outbreak for a while there. So it's the particular variant we have associated with this large cluster in New South Wales that's now threatening other states is one that I think shows that, as I said, our contact tracing, no matter how rapid it is, how quickly people step up for testing, you know, it's still at a point where you get to a case, you go to their contacts, and they're already infectious by a day or so. So people are going from that exposure to being infectious within 24 to 48 hours. Very hard to get your contact tracing done, find the person and get them into quarantine in 24 hours. You'll do it for some, you'll do it for half, but you won't be able to do it for all. So that then means there's this pressure now to go into these at least circuit breaker lockdowns. So you can find everyone, kind of put everything on hold, put everyone into quarantine in the population, find the people who have to stay there and then open up. So I'm not sure how well that's going to work because sometimes you can contain it without doing that. But the risk is now people are so nervous about this new variant that every time you see a few cases, people will jump on it. And in fact, we had that in Sydney. They had one weekend 10 cases. The next Saturday, it was 77 cases. Still not a lot, but by then they said, okay, we're not going to do local lockdown. We're not going to muck around. We're going to go into Sydney-wide lockdown. And people were saying, you should have gone earlier because these other little clusters were there, which no one could see at the time. But the weekend earlier, we had six cases, with, you know, four that they knew would be coming in with the results overnight. So 10 cases, but people were saying that's enough to completely lock down a city of 7 or 8 million people. So that's the problem. This is, if we're going to have to do that to hold this off, we can't do that for very long because repeat lockdowns has bigger health impacts, bigger economic impacts, because businesses that might survive one or two waves of lockdown will reach a point where they'll be vulnerable. And people with mental health issues and concerns and anxiety, you know, all of those things also get so much more difficult every time you add an additional layer of lockdown.
Right. All right. Well, Catherine, I think that's all the time we have on the show tonight. I want to thank you so much for joining us and sharing your perspective on what's happening there in Australia. Thanks for speaking with us tonight.
Thank you.
That was our conversation with Professor Catherine Bennett of Deakin University, wrapping up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutan, signing off the evening.
Thank you so much for watching the show tonight. Good night.